And now, the opinion of the Supreme Court of the United States in Pulsifer v. United States, decided March 15, 2024. Justice Kagan delivered the opinion of the court, in which Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Thomas, Alito, Kavanaugh, and Barrett joined. Justice Gorsuch filed a dissenting opinion in which Justices Sotomayor and Jackson joined. The safety valve provision of federal sentencing law exempts certain defendants from mandatory minimum penalties, thus enabling courts to give them lighter prison terms. To qualify for safety valve relief, a defendant must meet various criteria, one of which addresses his criminal history. That criterion, in stylized form, requires that a defendant does not have A, B, and C, where A, B, and C refer to three ways in which past criminality may suggest future dangerousness and therefore warrant a more severe sentence. In brief, A, B, and C are more than four criminal history points, a three-point offense, and a two-point violent offense. The question presented is how to understand the criminal history requirement. The government contends that the phrase does not have A, B, and C creates a checklist with three distinct conditions. On that view, a defendant meets the requirement and so is eligible for safety valve relief if he does not have A, does not have B, and does not have C. Or stated conversely, a person fails to meet the requirement and so cannot get relief if he has any one of the three. The petitioner here instead contends that the phrase does not have A, B, and C sets out a single, amalgamated condition for relief. On his reading, a defendant meets the requirement and is eligible for relief, so long as he does not have the combination of A, B, and C, or, put conversely, he fails to meet the requirement and cannot get relief only when he has all three. Today, we agree with the government's view of the criminal history provision. Part 1. Congress sometimes establishes mandatory minimum penalties for crimes, including drug offenses. Those provisions put a lower limit on a court's sentencing discretion, reflecting Congress's judgment that specified conduct demands no less than a specified punishment. For drug offenses of the kind involved here, the existence and length of minimum penalties typically depend on the type and quantity of the drug at issue, the harm resulting from the crime, and the defendant's criminal history. The safety valve provision, 18 U.S.C. Section 3553F, offers some defendants convicted of drug offenses an escape from otherwise applicable mandatory minimums. Under the provision, a court is to sentence a defendant without regard to any statutory minimum if it finds that five criteria are met. Three of the criteria focus on characteristics of the offense. In brief, whether the defendant used violence, whether the crime resulted in death or serious injury, and whether the defendant acted as a ringleader. One of the criteria addresses the defendant's cooperation with the government. And one, the first listed and the most relevant here, concerns the defendant's criminal history. The complete text of the safety valve provision is set out in this opinion's appendix. The criminal history requirement, we usually call it paragraph F1, recently underwent a substantial revision, making it easier for a defendant to meet. As originally enacted, The paragraph limited safety valve relief to defendants who did not have more than one criminal history point, as determined under the sentencing guidelines. What that meant in practice, we explain why just below, was that anything more than a single minor crime barred a defendant from gaining relief. But that is no longer so. In the First Step Act of 2018, Congress relaxed the safety valve provision's criminal history requirement, enabling defendants with more significant criminal records to qualify. Today, paragraph F1 is met if the court finds at sentencing that the defendant does not have A. more than 4 criminal history points, excluding any criminal history points resulting from a 1-point offense, as determined under the sentencing guidelines. B. a prior 3-point offense, as determined under the sentencing guidelines. And C. a prior 2-point violent offense, as determined under the sentencing guidelines. And if the defendant also meets Section 3553F's other 4 criteria, he becomes exempt from a statutory minimum. As the text makes clear, the new paragraph F1, like the old one, turns on the defendant's criminal history points under the guidelines. In general, the severity of guidelines sentencing recommendations increases with the number of criminal history points the defendant has, often called his criminal history score. And the guidelines assign more points to more serious prior offenses. There is a caveat to that rule, which will become pertinent later. Some prior convictions, even if for serious offenses, do not add any points to a defendant's score. That is true, for example, if the conviction is quite old or if it was rendered by a foreign court. But putting such exceptions aside, convictions resulting in longer prison sentences add more points to a defendant's total. As previewed above, the guidelines award 1 point for minor offenses, specifically for those resulting in sentences of less than 60 days. In the new paragraph F1, those minor sentences do not matter at all. Because of the excluding phrase, they cannot, either alone or in combination, prevent a defendant from gaining safety valve relief. But longer sentences generating more points fall within the paragraph's notice. A prison sentence of between 60 days and 13 months earns 2 points under the guidelines. So a conviction punished with that sentence will count, for purposes of the paragraph, as a prior 2-point offense, assuming it is also violent. Moving up another notch, a sentence exceeding 13 months earns 3 points under the guidelines. So a conviction giving rise to that greater penalty will qualify under the paragraph as a prior 3-point offense. This case involves a dispute about whether paragraph F1 bars petitioner Mark Pulsifer from gaining safety valve relief. Pulsifer pleaded guilty in 2020 to distributing at least 50 grams of methamphetamine. He faced a mandatory minimum of 15 years in prison unless the safety valve provision came to his aid. The government claimed it did not because Pulsifer could not meet its criminal history requirement. Pulsifer had 2 relevant prior convictions, each for a 3-point offense. In the government's view, that fact disqualified Pulsifer from obtaining relief several times over. He had not just 1, but 2 prior 3-point offenses, as specified in subparagraph B of the requirement. And because 3 plus 3 equals 6, He also had more than 4 criminal history points, as specified in subparagraph A. But Pulsifer claimed that was still not enough. He pointed out that his criminal record lacked a 2-point violent offense, as specified in subparagraph C. And in his view, only the combination of the items listed in the 3 subparagraphs, the full package, as it were, could prevent him from getting safety valve relief. The district court rejected Pulsifer's argument, ruling that a defendant is ineligible for safety valve relief if he has any of the 3 things specified in paragraph F1. The mandatory minimum, the court concluded, thus applied to Pulsifer's sentence. The Court of Appeals for the 8th Circuit affirmed. The court framed the question as in what sense the statute uses the word and. In the abstract, the court stated, the phrase "the defendant does not have A, B, and C" might be read in 2 different ways. It could mean that the defendant does not have the combination of the 3 elements listed in A, B, and C, as Pulsifer urged. Or it could mean, as the government urged, that the defendant does not have every one of those elements. In other words, that he does not have A, does not have B, and does not have C. In choosing between those readings, the court found a strong textual basis to prefer the government's. If Pulsifer were right, the court explained, subparagraph A would be rendered superfluous without the slightest effect. A defendant who has a prior 3-point offense under subparagraph B and a prior 2-point violent offense under subparagraph C would always meet the criterion in subparagraph A because he would always have more than 4 criminal history points. That was reason enough to read paragraph F1 the other way, as an eligibility checklist of 3 distinct conditions, each of which the defendant must meet to qualify for safety valve relief. And on that view, the court concluded, Pulsifer could not escape a mandatory minimum because he had a pair of 3-point offenses. It was simply immaterial that he did not also have a prior 2-point violent offense. We granted certiorari because the courts of appeals have split over how to read the safety valve provision's criminal history requirement. Today we adopt the government's view and so affirm the decision below. A defendant is eligible for safety valve relief under paragraph F1 only if he does not have all 3 of the items listed, or, said more specifically, he does not have 4 criminal history points, does not have a prior 3-point offense, and does not have a prior 2-point violent offense. The paragraph thus creates an eligibility checklist and demands that a defendant satisfy every one of its conditions. Part 2. We start with paragraph F1's grammatical structure, because Pulsifer's main argument, and initially the dissent's, is that it resolves this case. Recall that the paragraph requires a court to find that the defendant does not have the features specified in subparagraphs A, B, and C. Because Congress used and to connect those subparagraphs, Pulsifer contends, a defendant is ineligible for safety valve relief only if he has the complete combo, i.e., more than 4 criminal history points plus a prior 3-point offense plus a prior 2-point violent one. That result follows, Pulsifer claims, simply from what ordinary grammar says. but in fact, grammar does not say so much. There are two grammatically permissible ways to read paragraph F1. Yes, one is Pulsifer's, but the other is the government's, that a defendant is ineligible for relief unless he can satisfy each of the paragraph's three conditions. The choice between the two, as this part shows, is not a matter of grammatical rules. It can sensibly be made only by examining, as the next part does, the paragraph's content, as read in conjunction with the guidelines, or as we usually say in statutory construction cases, by reviewing text in context. And, in grammatical terms, is, of course, a conjunction, a word whose function is to connect specified items. Both parties here agree with that elementary proposition. The word and, each might say, means, well, and. Indeed, to the extent elaboration is needed, both parties select the same definition from the same dictionary. And, they recite in concert, means along with or together with. Where things get more complicated is in figuring out what goes along or together with what, or otherwise said, what the and in paragraph F1 connects. As Pulsifer reads the paragraph, the and joins three features of a defendant's criminal history into a single disqualifying characteristic. The conjunction of subparagraphs A, B, and C produces the thing he labels the complete combo. The question then becomes whether the defendant has or does not have that full package. Some grade school math notation may help reveal the proposed ordering. It is as if Pulsifer inserted parentheses into the paragraph so that it asks whether the defendant does not have parentheses A, B, and C parentheses, much as a student would solve 5 minus parentheses 2 plus 1 parentheses. By first adding 2 and 1, and then subtracting the sum from 5. So Pulsifer wants a court to combine A, B, and C, and then to determine whether the defendant has the total. By contrast, the government reads the statute without parentheses, and so arrives at a different conclusion. On its view, the does not have language operates on A and on B and on C consecutively rather than on the three combined. So the and connects three criminal history conditions, all of which must be satisfied to gain safety valve relief. Or said another way, paragraph F1 requires that the defendant does not have A, and also does not have B, and finally does not have C. If he has even one, he cannot complete the requisite checklist, and so cannot gain the safety valve's benefits. The government's view rests on a routine aspect of expression, that an introductory phrase, here, does not have, may apply to or modify several terms coming after it, one by one. Suppose a person says after visiting a bookstore, I bought a novel, a memoir, and a travel guide. That is just a more efficient way of saying, I bought a novel, bought a memoir, and bought a travel guide. The verb in the sentence carries over. Some grammarians use the term distributes to every item on the ensuing list. That practice is pervasive, indeed inescapable, in every kind of speech and writing. Consider this perhaps half-remembered line from childhood. Quote, on Saturday, he ate through one piece of chocolate cake, one ice cream cone, one pickle, one slice of Swiss cheese, one slice of salami, one lollipop, one piece of cherry pie, one sausage, one cupcake, and one slice of watermelon, unquote. The introductory words ate through apply independently and equivalently to each of the 10 foodstuffs that follow. Or, if that example seems too trifling, take a couple from the Constitution. Article 3 provides that the judicial power shall extend to all cases arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and treaties. That statement means, but says more concisely, that the judicial power extends to cases arising under the Constitution, extends to cases arising under federal law, and extends to cases arising under treaties. The provision does not, as Pulsifer's view might suggest, limit judges to hearing the few cases arising simultaneously under all three kinds of law. Similarly, Article 1 of the Constitution enables Congress to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states, and with the Indian tribes. That authorization goes to commerce involving each kind of entity, not just to commerce involving the three at once. So again, the verb phrase operates on each term seriatim, not on the combination of the three. Pulsifer claims that verb phrases do not work the same way when framed in the negative. One of his favorite examples is, quote, don't drink and drive, unquote. That doesn't mean, he observes, that you shouldn't drink and that you shouldn't drive, but only means that you shouldn't do both at the same time. So too, he says, for don't clean the bathroom with bleach and ammonia. The prohibition does not go to bleach alone and to ammonia alone. Instead, it goes only to the two in conjunction. To return to math notation, the statement is best understood as don't clean with parentheses bleach and ammonia parentheses. Rather than don't clean with bleach and don't clean with ammonia. And so too, he says, here. Paragraph F1 conditions relief on a court's finding that a defendant does not have parentheses A, B, and C parentheses. Rather than that he does not have A, does not have B, and does not have C. But for every negative statement Pulsifer offers up, another cuts the opposite way, suggesting, as we later discuss, that here grammar is not the primary determinant of meaning. Consider two sentences discussed in The Cambridge Grammar of the English Language. If someone says, I'm not free on Saturday and Sunday, the grammar notes he most likely means, I'm not free on Saturday and I'm not free on Sunday. He is not saying that although he cannot go away for a full weekend, he can make plans on one of those days. Similarly, if a person says, I didn't like his mother and father, he probably means, I didn't like his mother and I didn't like his father. Not that he didn't like the two in combination, but thought that either alone was fine. Or take an example raised in oral argument pertaining, like paragraph F1, to an eligibility requirement. A hospital tells you that it can perform a medical procedure only if you don't eat, drink, and smoke for the preceding 12 hours. Even if Pulsifer's counsel agreed that he would not feel free to have a steak and martini so long as he abstained from tobacco. The don't here, unlike in Pulsifer's examples, carries over to each action on the list, eating, drinking, and smoking alike, not just to the three in tandem. And if those examples of negatively framed statements, both Pulsifer's and ours, seem a tad conversational, consider a statute strikingly similar in form to paragraph F1. First, return to that paragraph to remind yourself of how it looks and reads. Paragraph F1 is met if the court finds at sentencing that the defendant does not have A. more than 4 criminal history points, excluding any criminal history points resulting from a 1-point offense as determined under the sentencing guidelines. B. a prior 3-point offense as determined under the sentencing guidelines. And C. a prior 2-point violent offense as determined under the sentencing guidelines. And if the defendant also meets Section 3553F's other 4 criteria, he becomes exempt from a statutory minimum. Now check out 34 U.S.C. Section 20101F. As used in this section, the term offenses against the United States does not include 1. A criminal violation of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, 2. An offense against the laws of the District of Columbia, and 3. An offense triable by an Indian tribunal court or court of Indian offenses. The does not include language at the top, of course, refers independently to crimes satisfying number 1, crimes satisfying number 2, and crimes satisfying number 3. Not to whatever crimes manage to satisfy 1, 2, and 3 all at once. Or said otherwise, the statute means exactly what it would mean if Congress had stripped the phrase does not include from the prefatory line and repeated it 3 times in the subsequent list. Congress, we recognize, just opted to draft more concisely. And so, too, it could have made that choice in drafting paragraph F1 with the does not have phrase referring to every item that follows. No grammatical principle precludes that understanding of what Congress wrote. Pulsifer protests that using the word or instead of and would have better conveyed the government's reading, but that claim also fails. His basic objection, echoed in the dissent, is that Congress could have expressed its intent more clearly. If the government is right about paragraph F1's meaning, Pulsifer asks, why didn't Congress just use or? Doing so would have shown unequivocally that a defendant must meet all 3 of the specified conditions. To begin with, we do not demand, or in truth expect, that Congress draft in the most translucent way possible. We have routinely construed statutes to have a particular meaning, even as we acknowledged that Congress could have expressed itself more clearly. And anyway, we doubt that substituting or for and would have delivered us from interpretive controversy. Instead, we would likely have confronted the mirror image of the dispute before us. The government would have read the requirement that a defendant does not have A, B, or C to mean that he does not have parentheses A, B, or C parentheses. So a defendant would get safety valve relief only if he doesn't have any of the three listed criminal history features. But Pulsifer, we suspect, would have read the same requirement to mean that a defendant does not have A, does not have B, or does not have C. So he would get safety valve relief as long as he doesn't have a single one of the listed features. That reading, too, is possible when viewed only as a matter of abstract grammar, divorced from any analysis of A, B, and C's content. Even with Pulsifer's proposed redrafting, then, the grammatical back and forth would continue. In fact, we can see why a Congress wishing to express the government's view might have chosen to use and. Suppose that before putting words to the page, Congress had decided, as the government says, to create an eligibility checklist requiring a defendant to meet three distinct conditions before getting safety valve relief. In the subsequent drafting process, an and could well have seemed intuitive. After all, on the government's checklist view, a defendant must meet every one of three conditions. This one, and this one, and this one. Or, said more concretely, the defendant must not have more than four criminal history points, and must not have a three-point offense, and must not have a two-point violent offense. So why not use an and? It serves to connect the three necessary conditions coming off the efficient prefatory language. In other words, Congress might have thought that use of the conjunctive word and would reflect the needed conjunction of three requirements. Consider as a summary of all these points, Pulsifer's own main example, because it shows why paragraph F1's grammatical structure cannot decide this case, and points to the kind of analysis needed instead. Pulsifer offers a college policy with an and connecting three provisions. All student athletes are eligible for an academic scholarship, provided that the student, during the previous semester, did not A. miss more than five classes, B. fail to submit a paper in the semesterly campus-wide writing competition, and C. earn less than a 3.0 GPA. In Pulsifer's view, the policy is clear. A student may retain his scholarship unless he flunks all three of the conditions. So a student, Pulsifer contends, is in the clear if he submitted a paper in the writing competition and earned a 3.4 GPA, even though he missed 7 classes, which sounds reasonable enough. But how about this one? A student who misses only 4 classes but fails to submit a competition paper and earns a 1.0 GPA. Or similarly, a student who submits a terrible paper while missing all his classes and obtaining the same D average. Is it now so clear that the policy allows a student to flunk 2 of the conditions rather than requiring him to satisfy all 3? Or is it, at the least, uncertain? And even supposing not, consider a variation. All student athletes are eligible for an academic scholarship provided that the student during the previous semester did not A. fail a course, semicolon, B. commit plagiarism, semicolon, and C. get arrested. A student would need a lot of confidence to argue that he remains scholarship eligible when he A. failed a course and B. committed plagiarism, but C. managed to evade arrest. That reading, Pulsifer's reading, is grammatically possible, but so too is the opposite, that a student must meet all 3 conditions. And when we think about the content of the policy, what A, B, and C actually say, against the backdrop of all we know or perchance all the college handbook tells us about academic scholarships, we cannot read the revised hypothetical in Pulsifer's way. The takeaway is this. Paragraph F1 cannot be construed in the abstract as if all a reader has to go on is the stripped-down phrase, "The defendant does not have A, B, and C." That might require the defendant not to have parentheses A, B, and C parentheses, i.e., the combination of the 3. Or it might require the defendant not to have A and not to have B and not to have C, i.e., each of the 3. Really, it all depends. It is notable that even the dissent must, in the end, concede the point, noting that whether a speaker intends for a listener to distribute words implicitly depends on the context. The way a reader assigns meaning to the phrase is to look at the substance of A, B, and C, the items on the list, and the way they interact, as against relevant background understandings. We interpret the injunction against drinking and driving in Pulsifer's way. Do not, parentheses A and B parentheses, because the 2 activities are usually perilous only in combination. We interpret the injunction against eating and drinking before surgery in the government's way. Do not A and do not B, because each activity alone is likely to have adverse consequence. Similarly, here the meaning of paragraph F1 may become clear if we examine the content of its 3 subparagraphs, what they say and how they relate to each other, as well as how they fit with other pertinent law, or stated in the usual language of statutory construction, the answer may lie in considering the paragraph's text in its legal context. We've come to the end of part 1 of this opinion, but don't worry, next episode we will pick up right where this episode left off. Until then, thanks for listening to What SCOTUS Wrote Us.